I am especially grateful for the opportunity to work on this subject and to present it here at Truett and Baylor. One reason is that one of my ancestors, Norman Brady, was a cheerleader at Baylor in 1950, and Norman died in September this year. And his funeral and memorial service in Houston included some of his early friends from Baylor University. It was an important part of his life, lifelong. I'm not sure Baylor wants to admit to that, but Norman did. The other reason I'm particularly grateful to be working on this subject and presenting it here to you today is that little did I know when I agreed with Dr. Long and Dr. Creech to organize and hold this conference here that I would be discussing the death of my mother as an illustration of the challenges and opportunities that death provides for working on differentiation of self, but I am indeed privileged to do so. Mother died on January 17th, and I will refer to those experiences, some of them, as I talk about death as a time that stirs reactions and patterns of reaction in any family, a time when it is easier and more possible to observe the levels of differentiation in the family and in oneself. And death is a time when it is possible to take steps to work on differentiation that accumulate and develop emotional maturity over time. I want to present some of how Dr. Bowen writes about and describes differentiation of self. This is one of the most poorly understood concepts in Bowen theory. It's one of the concepts most often bypassed or left out as people pick up aspects of theory and integrate it in their work. It's probably one of the most important and unusual concepts in a definition of human nature, that in fact we are not isolated individuals, but that we are connected with each other in biological, psychological, physiological, in the broad category of emotional ways. We are emotionally connected to each other and react out of that connectedness only with every breath we take. That emotional reactivity varies based upon the ability of individuals to be separate from those with whom we are connected, to have enough independence to think for self, to some extent interrupt and alter the reactivity to others, to modify reactivity by thoughtfulness, by a knowledge, by thinking for self, the ability to be separate from the emotions of others and choose a direction or a response based on principles or purposes or thoughtfulness. We all react. That reactivity varies depending on our ability to be separate and thoughtful individuals. The degrees of fusion between emotion and intellect within the individual, the degrees to which emotional reactivity will flood the intellect and the ability to be thoughtful at or around a time of death, that varies between people based on what Bowen called the scale of differentiation of self. The more one is fused emotionally with others and experiences the reactions of others in one's own brain and physiology, the harder it is to be separate. And the fusion between emotion, below the eyeballs and intellect corresponds to the fusion between people and families. We come out of our families as young adults with a level of differentiation that is about the same, maybe slightly higher, maybe slightly lower than our parents. Like it or not, it's nature's way of producing patterns of reactivity that are associated with survival and adaptation. With that, let me give you Dr. Seuss's version. You think differentiation of self is a scientific concept. Well, Dr. Seuss nailed it. A father, a mother, two sisters, a brother, whose horns are connected from one to the other, whose horns are so mixed they can't tell them apart, can't tell where they end, can't tell where they start. Each deer's mighty puzzled. He's never yet found if his horns are hers or the other way round. I'm going to jump around a little bit, given the time to present today, and some examples I'm just going to put in when they make sense to do it. This would be one. One of the observations of emotional fusion it was possible to make at my mother's funeral and the service that and burial and the family gatherings that followed was whose tears were being shed. Was I crying for myself and my relationship with my mother? Or were my tears, was I crying for my father and his relationship with mother? Or as I sat behind my daughter and watched her lean her head on my dad's shoulders, was I crying my daughter's tears? It was really possible to see the difference when I was crying for myself or for dad or for my daughter. That was proved to be a helpful observation as I talked and thought with my granddaughter, who was crying for everybody at that particular funeral and a little overwhelmed by the experience. Reactivity is visible not so much in what people say, but in how they function. Reactivity is visible not only in how people feel, but in the behavior and the patterns of behavior that play out in a family. This is one of the ways that I've tried to picture this in a slide. Oops, back up. That these patterns of reacting to relationships, distance, conflict, let me get my own version here so I don't have to look away to do this, I will have to look away. Distance, conflict, functioning for others instead of for self, and depending on someone else instead of on self, the development of symptoms within the individual, and the projection of a problem onto the child or onto another. These patterns of reaction are stirred around death, and one can better observe the reactivity patterns that are a challenge in one's own life during times of death, when they are more visible and more pronounced. Examples of that would be I'm jumping ahead of myself. Dr. Bowen recognized that we have, alongside the reactivity that's stirred in relationships to others, an ability to recognize that reaction, to observe, think, abstract, and understand the natural order and govern ourselves differently. If I were going to tattoo my arm, this is one of the things I think I'd tattoo on the left arm to remind myself to practice and work on governing myself a little differently. Times of death provide many opportunities for people to work on differentiation, to observe the challenges their own reactivity and participation in patterns presents themselves and the family, and to work on managing self differently. This is another of my favorite. I think this one would get tattooed on my right arm. To remind me to assume responsibility for myself and my own distress. Contain my own emotional reactions a little better. Blame others less. And control my own reactivity as I work on being a more responsible participant in the family around a death. Reactivity to death is going to be present for any family. The difference at lower and higher levels of differentiation. The goal in working on differentiation is not to stop reacting. That happens years after death. But to be able to better observe that reactivity and to modify one's own in relation to others. At lower levels of differentiation and higher levels of emotional fusion, when one reacts, all react. At higher levels of differentiation, it is possible for one to react and others remain stable and separate and be more of a resource to each other, thoughtfully, functionally. Our levels of differentiation, high, lower and higher, are expressed in all aspects of our functioning and govern our sensitivity to stress, to relationships in the environment, and have an impact on symptoms and health. Some examples around death of lower levels of differentiation that are visible is you can see prolonged dependence on others, on the medical care system or on other family members, a prolonged dependence that occupies the energy of the system and exhausts resources. At lower levels of differentiation, people are more likely to think, feel, and say, much of my life died with, I am in the grave with, there is loss of self. At lower levels of differentiation, it's possible to see one person assume more responsibility for everyone and everything, while others distance or avoid responsible involvement. This is a backdrop, an emotional pattern that often plays out as conflict erupting over estates and cutoff between generations and siblings between siblings that last generations. Since my mother died, in my practice, I have had the opportunity now to work with 10 people who've experienced the death of a parent or who are experiencing the death of a parent in the last few months. And the backdrop of cutoff is evident and described as one older daughter finds herself reacting to her mother's reliance on her younger brother and younger sister and leaves her out. She talks about an interesting story where her mother wanted to move her bed, and she wanted to move her bed to one of her children's home, and she's promised the bed to every one of her children. There's only one bed. And this oldest daughter is reacting as if her mother likes her brother and sister better, and she's not going to talk to them ever again. When she began to review the history of her family, Guess what happened in her mother's family? Her mother and three younger siblings became cut off around the estate of her parents or grandparents when they died, and left this daughter responsible for more than the other siblings. That is not an unusual process when you research the history of families that are having a hard time with conflict and responsibility around dying. At moderate to higher levels of differentiation, more vulnerable family members may develop symptoms, but they will use those symptoms to make major life changes in their lifestyle or in their functioning for the better. In the aftermath of my mother's death, it was interesting to note which of the two grandchildren were sick within a week of her death. The youngest of all the grandchildren, great-grandchildren, the youngest of all the great-grandchildren was sick. And the two oldest females' grandchildren were sick with depression and mono and fatigue. It's interesting to note. All of them have recovered and put more time and life energy into schoolwork, making changes in lifestyle that represent a pull-up in the family. At moderate to higher levels of differentiation, in spite of the failing health and increased dependence, both dying people as well as other family members exhibit responsibility for self and help out in more realistic ways. This can include advanced directives for medical care. It can include plans for funeral and burial, plans for estate management. Not just doing them, but discussing them with all of the relevant family members and friends. Given a low to moderate level of differentiation of self, I've observed that taking steps to work on differentiation, being a more mature, thoughtful, observant family member, functions to modify the reactivity around the death of an important family member. But this project did not begin simply with the death of my mother in 2003, but that one person's work on differentiation has a cumulative effect over time and can begin with the next breath. One who will do that will interrupt the transmission of anxiety in their family and system, will increase the ability to control and manage their own reactivity, develop greater separateness or independence, and that will be evident in physiology as well as in thinking and functioning. This work modifies one's own functioning and the functioning of the family to some extent. Now, I'm going to give examples of differentiation of self and work on differentiation of self in my own family that began in 1975. And I'm going to pull from that longer story some examples of how the deaths and attending and being present and accounted for at deaths and funerals in my family have contributed to that effort in significant ways. This project that began for me in 1975 began as a way of improving my own functioning after about a decade of life as any parent's nightmare and cut off completely from my family. It began as an effort to modify my own miserable situation and continued as basic training as a therapist and as an adult, contributing member of my society. I was about the age that some of you are, perhaps a little older, at about 30. If I can do it, I will illustrate some of the cumulative benefit of these projects as I most recently experienced in the most powerful death in my life. Let me, I like checklists. I like having a to-do list. Any of you could formulate your own checklist if you carefully read Murray Bowen's book, Family Therapy and Clinical Practice. Embedded in his chapters and papers are all of the steps involved in working on differentiation itself. I recommend that project to anybody who would do it. Those who won't do it can start off using my checklists. If anybody wants copies of the PowerPoints, let me know and I'll be glad to email those to you if you would find them useful. But steps toward differentiation involve developing the ability to see the system and one's part in it, to recognize and manage your own reactivity, to interrupt and reduce anxiety in self, to increase functioning in a responsible fashion, being responsible for self as distinct for others, from others, developing a way to be a more separate self in all important relationships, something that did not come intuitively to me, and increasing the separation between thinking and reacting that makes it possible then to integrate thinking and reacting and to define a self. Now, these broad projects include these very specific methods and activities to increase contact with family. Now think about it. How does a death provide any of us the opportunity to increase contact with more members of the family? Funerals are a wonderful opportunity to increase contact with family, and I made it a point to go to every funeral from 1975 to now that happens in my family, and there have been a lot of them. And those funerals have provided one of the most important, I'm already lost track of time. I am going to talk and stop talking. I'm going to stop talking at 2:45. Okay. One of the most important funerals I attended was after Katrina. My oldest living aunt, emailed me that the last of my grandfather's generation had died in Katrina. That a relative named Ada Dahl had been killed in the bus that exploded en route to Dallas from the evacuation of the nursing home in Bel Air. I didn't know that family existed in 2000 and what was that, eight? When was Katrina? Thank you. I didn't know that branch of my family even existed. And when I looked, her funeral was held at the Lutheran Church 15 minutes from my home in Houston, Texas. So I canceled my appointments and went. Didn't know a soul. But as I stood in the vestibule and watched just hundreds of people flood the church, I just asked a few that looked like they could be cousins, did they know the children of Ada? I knew she had two daughters. And one of them worked with my cousin, Polly. and agreed to slip my card to Polly with a note saying that I had come to her mother's funeral. She didn't know me, but that I was joining her in celebrating her mother's life and sorrow for the loss, and I would call in a week or two. That cousin has become one of my best friends, and she has a whole branch of my family available to me now that I did not know. My mother looks like Polly's mother, and she and I have had wonderful exchanges about her mother's side and my mother's side of the same family. Being present at deaths and funerals has provided many opportunities for increased contact with family and finding ways to do it that are respectful, both of the family's experience and of my own interest. I was probably the happiest person at Ada Dahl's funeral because I was thrilled to find this whole branch of my family newly available. And I just had to not smile too damn much. Else I'd be. Increasing contact with family brings alive the emotional reactivity that has existed in the family over generations. My mother was not thrilled that I had met this branch of her father's family. Why bother? We haven't known them for years. If you have a few extra days, why don't you come out here and see me? You are going to go spend it seeing these Norwegians? Bringing alive the emotional reactivity and the patterns of reaction allow one to see them better, to understand their impact over generations, to learn more about them. Who, what, where, when, and how did my mother's line and my cousin's line cut off, and what went into the cutoff? Expand contact beyond one's parents. Be present at times when anxiety and intensity are high and more visible. Learn more facts about the family. All of these steps to working on differentiation of self, increasing the ability to respond thoughtfully. All of you have had questions about that today. Basic training, your own family. This is where you get the practice. This is where you get the practice that lets you minister or counsel as a therapist without reliance on technique. Technique will fall short in the presence of heightened emotion and anxiety. But this is where one learns to train the brain to be sensitive to the experience of another without losing self in that, and being able then to serve as a resource in relating to the reactions of others from the ability to be separate and thoughtful, factual. Practice, practice. One can define principles for living by attending funerals and define principles for responding to and relating to the deaths of others. You can know that I am thinking much more realistically about what is involved in preparing myself and my family for my death, having watched carefully, thoughtfully, reactively, the experience my mother had with the medical field and with the family in the last month of her life. This is where we define principles for living and for relating to the challenges of others. I add pray, pray, pray. Now that's Victoria. Most of this other is out of Marie Bowen. But I add pray, pray, pray. And my version of pray is help me contain the emotional reactions that will shut me down and shut down the possibility for a genuine contact and a thoughtful contact with this other person or in this situation. Help me. Now I just say, help me. God knows what I'm talking about. And then I watch to see what comes out of my mouth and into my thoughts when I am able to contain the reactivity that is so predictable, to blame, criticize, conflict, overhelp. When I can contain those patterns of reactivity in my own oldest sister self, then I'm able to see what else can emerge that represents differentiation, a greater level of maturity. And I'll give you some examples, if I may. How much depth? I may not get to talk so much about my mother because I don't want to miss the chance to talk to you about hers. This was probably the second most powerful and important death that allowed me to learn so much about myself and my family and about this process of working on differentiation. I'd been present at many deaths by the time my grandmother, my mother's mother, began to die. But that was all very helpful. But when my mother's mother began to die, the strongest pattern of reactivity stirred was her dependence on my mother and her son and on anyone and everyone to function for her. My mother's mother was a 350-pound woman who had held up much of her life, but the last 10 years her legs and strength had begun to fail. And she was living at home on her own after her husband's death until she began to not be able to stand up. She would holler for help to Houston, and her son would do his best to get her the help she needed. I began to travel back to Bryan College Station where she lived one Thursday a week to try to be with her in this state of dependence and pain, to see if I could relate to her, my mother, and my uncle in a more responsible, thoughtful way. What the heck would it mean to do that? I had no idea. I had friends who told me this and that about strategies for helping people be more responsible for themselves, and I was going to try them all. None of them worked. But what I did find was that when I was able to relate to this woman in terms of her ability to be responsible for herself, when I could relate to her and say, you know, I don't think anybody's going to be able to take that pain away. No amount of medicine's going to do it. She would begin to function better and not rely as much on pain meds. When I could say, oh, well, her son arranged for her to be hospitalized in the best nursing home in Bryan College Station. So she was there. I saw her there. She was furious. She hated it. She wanted me to spring her. I'm ready. Let's go. Take me home. Define myself. I cannot take you home. But if you can get home on your own steam, I'll certainly continue to visit you once a week in your own home. She did it. She found a woman who would take her, would come to the house every day and spring her from the nursing home. She got her, picked her up, took her home, and she lived at home for another year. This woman could do things for herself once she knew she had to do it. And I was able to interact with my mother and my uncle in a way that both of them were able to say, I can't move you in and take care of you full time. I cannot do that and take care of myself. Very courageous for them to be able to do that. The last month of grandmother's life was pretty remarkable. she talked about dying. She asked if I would, well, before she talked about dying, she asked if I would move in and set up a cot in her room because I was such good company that nobody else was coming to visit. And I had to tell her that I could not move in and stay there all week long, that I had to go out about my life and try to be as good a grandmother as she had been to me. Then she wanted to know what kind of grandmother she had been to me. And we got to talk about all the contributions she had made to my life as a grandmother that she'd forgotten or didn't realize were as important to me as they were. That was a wonderful thread of conversation the last couple of months of her life. And then she began to talk about dying. And her biggest question to me, most of these visits were just by myself. And then I'd visit with my mother and my uncle by myself. Again, one of the ideas in Bowen's methodology is to make and maintain one-to-one contact with every living member, important member of the family. And to do that with parents, unfamiliar though it may be, to make and maintain time one-on-one with parents, siblings, aunts, uncles, cousins, grandparents, and to keep that up. And in one of the conversations with my grandmother, she said, "Why doesn't God let me in? I've been knocking on the door twice now, and God doesn't want me. What are you talking about?" And she told me that she had nearly died twice and had been taken to the emergency room and given a blood transfusion one time, and being treated the second time, and had come back to the nursing home. So I nearly died twice, but they took me to ER and brought me back. "Oh, Mammy, God didn't lock you out. You called for help and got it. Your son, when you call him at 2 a.m, bleeding, is going to call the doctors and they're going to take you to the emergency room. And they're going to do what doctors and nurses do. They're going to treat you and help you recover if you can. They just did what they could do to keep you alive." The next week, she stopped eating and said to everyone that she had started a diet, and they let her get away with it. She developed a urinary infection that became systemic, and she didn't tell anybody. By the end of that week, she had begun to die actively and was unconscious before and without letting her children know who would have called for treatment and help. Before she became unconscious, I had a wonderful afternoon with my mother and grandmother. When it became clear that she was dying. And my grandmother said that she was afraid. My mother was in the back of the room, and grandmother and I were up close. I was at her bedside, and she said she was afraid of dying. Now, I asked her what she was afraid of, and she said, "I've never gone anywhere alone." And I said, "Who do you want to take with you?" My guess was it was me or mother. One of us were her favorite candidates. And she said, "My favorite people." And I said, "Well, I don't want my mother to go yet, if she can help it, because I think she's got a lot of work to do still, being a grandmother and a great-grandmother. She's got lots of contributions to make to this family if she can stick around. And I think I do, too." And my grandmother looked very glum. And I said, "Well, who will be there when you get to heaven? You won't be alone, will you?" And she began to recount those she looked forward to seeing: her husband, Jesus, God, her father, who she adored. She conspicuously left her mother off the list. And I said, what about your mother? At that point, my very weak grandmother sat up in bed, flashed her eyes, and I thought she was going to give me a black eye. She said, no, no, I don't care about seeing my mother. And I said, well, she's been with Jesus an awfully long time. Don't you think she'll be different? Aren't you curious? At that point, my mother zooms up and takes the spot at her mother's side, and I back off, and mother says, let me tell you about your mother's death. Turns out my mother was with her grandmother at her bedside when she died. And she said, Mammy, you would have been very proud of your mother. She died bravely, beautifully. And my grandmother's face softened, and they had a conversation I was not able to overhear. That's what I think is resolving unresolved emotional experience. That conversation made possible an understanding over these generations of the relationship process and the reactivity to each other that had shaped our lives in many ways. Within 3 days, grandmother died, and I joined my uncle and my mother at the hospital to await her death and was able to practice something that I was so grateful at the time of my own mother's death that I'd had this experience and had the chance to think through how to contain my inclination to try to organize everybody else, to control how somebody died, when somebody died, that they did it the right way, to be critical of medicine, all these patterns of reaction that I encountered as I stood in the hospital room with my mother and uncle and grandmother while she was hooked up to all the machines keeping her alive and keeping her heart beating. And I so wanted to step in and insist that the doctors take her off the machines and let God open her door or the door. But I thought, I know this reactivity in myself, and I can predict where it's going to lead if I do. So I said to the young Asian doctor who walked into the room, how long would grandmother live if you took her off the machines right now? And the young doctor said, with gentleness in his voice, she would live about 15 minutes. And I said, well, doctor, how long will she live if she stays on the machine? And he said, much to my gratitude, probably about 15 minutes. And that is what she did. I was relieved of the burden when I was able to contain that reactivity and allow everyone in the room to be responsible for themselves instead of assuming the responsibility for all involved, as I might have done. The time for this presentation is over, and I was able to present only about 3 of the more extensive examples of working on differentiation of self, that attending family funerals and being present at deaths in my family has provided. But I want to end with the last slide that describes the basic training for the therapist or minister or teacher or other person in being able to engage or activate a process of differentiation in the reactivity of another family depends on the ability to do it in one's own family and life. And I will end with the quotation that I found in Mother's Bible on a bookmark that I have kept with me, and will end this presentation with that.